5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello, welcome along to this week's episode of the Let's Get Running podcast. It's me, Sean Dixon. Good to have you along for the show. I'm on my own today. It's just an interview we've got with a very special guest, Mike Grattan, former winner of the London Marathon and bronze medalist at the 1982 Commonwealth Games in the marathon. He's going to talk to you about his career, so how he prepared for these races, what it was about him that made him such a good marathoner. The marathon running in his day in the 80s and sort of the races and the challenges he'd come up against in that period. Hopefully lots of advice that you can take away yourselves in your lead up to your spring marathons coming up, or perhaps for marathons later on down in the future. Now, we've had lots of messages come through, emails, a message on the Instagram about this month's features. Obviously, we're doing marathoning this month. We're keen for your questions and advice. We're going to answer them on the last show of the month, so please get those in. Me and Tom are going to pick through those and attempt to come up with some answers, some really good ones so far. If you wanted to get in touch at letsgetrunning.co.uk. If you follow us on Instagram or Twitter at letsgetrunning, you will be able to send us a message, and that'd be really great. We're happy to have those. You can also, if you're a user of WhatsApp, send us a recorded message. Now, here's the number you can call. It's +31 617 116121. That's +31 617 116121. If you send us a message and then you send us a recorded message, newfangled way, all the kids are doing it these days, we will play them out on live on the shows. That's a nice way of you getting in touch and getting involved with the show. Be nice to hear your voices. They can be funny, they can be straight, doesn't matter. You just get involved and get in, and send us a message. As always, we love reviews, we love ratings, even if they're not five star. We do like five star the best, but yeah, get in touch with whatever review you want to give us. That's really cool. Thanks, everybody. And here is the show with Mike. On today's show, we are talking to athlete, coach, and director of 209 Events, the sort of running, event company, I guess is the best way to describe it. But it's Mike Grattan. How are you doing, Mike?
I'm very good, thank you.
I've probably butchered what 209 Events is. Is that tally right? Is it events?
it's a lot of things. But our main income comes from travels of overseas events, particularly the marathon majors that have grown in a massive way. Actually, everybody wants to do them.
Yeah.
But we started by doing training camps in the Algarve back 37 years ago. So
wow. That
was the birth of it, and then we managed to get some entries for New York, and then it all grew from there. But we also organise races of a medium size in the UK, and we just had the Farnborough Half Marathon and Longleat 10K. So that's the kind of events we're putting on.
Great, nice. And specifically for this show, we're talking on this month about marathoning. So we really want to talk about your marathon credentials. And I was looking over your kind of record at marathons, and there's some pretty big highlights. So the Commonwealth Games bronze medal in 1982, the year I was born. So I was in nappies, and you were picking up a medal on the rostrum. And I'm the winner of the London Marathon in 1983 in your PB of 209, way back in 1983.
Yeah.
So obviously you've got great credentials in the marathon. What made you back then? Why did you go to marathon? Why were you suited specifically to marathon running, do you think?
Well, when I started running marathons, I didn't know I was suited for running marathons. It's a complete accident in many ways. I'd been English School's 5,000 champion back in 1974, which makes you feel very young indeed, probably. And then I went to university in Sussex, and I trained at Brighton Hove with Steve Ovett. And I was still running 1,500s, 5,000s then in national leagues with Ovett and doing Southern 1,500, just about making finals, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But while I was there, there was the librarian, a guy called Rab Heron, Scottish runner, who'd run 2:17. And he was training for London and Brighton. So he was going out and running 20 miles on Sunday. And I was running then with him. And then I'd drop off at 20 miles. He'd go on and do another 10 or so. Wow. So I had this strange mix of doing some really quick speed work with a vets group in Brighton and also doing long runs on several days a week with Rob Heron at the college. So I was doing the groundwork for marathon training, but still wanting to run on the road, on the track. When I left university, couldn't get a job teaching. I was a PE teacher. Couldn't get a job teaching straight away. So I worked on a building site and actually got my left foot run over and broke metatarsals in three places.
No.
So I was out for about 6 months. And in the meantime, I'd got a PE teaching job in Broadstairs in Kent and lived in Canterbury and joined in Invicta. This is 1979. And I just got back running again. I ran about 120 something in the national. I ran 51 minutes for 10 miles in Tonbridge and found out they were all going to the Essonne Marathon in Paris. And so I said, I'll tag along for a booty weekend.
Mm.
And I actually was getting quite fit quite quickly. And this was kind of late March that year and decided to run it just out of the blue. Mm. The days when you could get entries into marathons without going through a ballot 6 months in advance.
Yeah.
Entered it a few weeks before and ran 2:21. So I thought,
wow.
Perhaps I should be doing a bit more of this. And then my next one was the Poly Marathon, which I won in 2:19. And then the progress was as you described.
Yeah. How was your training then? Did you have a coach sort of giving you advice leading up after that initial marathon? Did you then go and seek advice from someone to give you some training advice to train for the next?
Not really, no. I having done a PE degree, I had fairly good grounding on physiology and I knew what was going on.
Yeah.
I'd also been doing the long run, so I never had any problems with that kind of adapting. But it was a bit of trial and error, and I didn't really get anybody to give me advice until 1981. I finished third in the 3A's marathon in rugby in 2:16, and I thought I could go to the next level.
Mm.
Good friend of mine was Cliff Temple, who was a Sunday Times athletics correspondent, but also had written books about marathons. So I asked him for some advice. We looked over my training. We tweaked a few things. The main tweak was I was running 140 odd miles a week.
Wow.
And extremely fit. But every time I did a marathon, I seemed to be getting to 22, 23 miles and then struggling. So he said, you're running tired. So cut it down. So we cut it down to 115 to 120, did a little bit more a kind of bulk interval training, 20, 25 times 400, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So concentrate a bit more on speed endurance. The improvement was immediate. And the next race was third in London in 2:12. So it was a little bit of tweaking of what I was doing that was needed. But up to that point, right through English schools, everything, I self-coached. I just had an interest in coaching. Even back then, I was coaching athletes that I was training with, setting club sessions in my original club, Folkestone. So
yeah.
I kind of always had an interest in coaching, but because of that, I was quite keen to coach myself.
And what were your principles then of training when you managed to make that jump after you finished third at the 3A's?
Yeah.
What did your training look like? Did you have I hate the word philosophy, really, but what was what was the key to your training that made you make that jump, other than obviously those days?
There wasn't very much in the way of change from when I was at university in Brighton. I was running 100-mile weeks then with this mixture of interval work at Brighton and running long runs with Rob Heron. And I kind of developed a system from that and it became kind of set, and all I did was tweak that a little bit.
Mm.
So instead of doing sessions like maybe, I don't know, 12 or so 400s in 60s, I started running 20 to 25 with a much shorter recovery, running them in 67s. So
yeah,
the emphasis was less on flat out speed. I'd run a 49-second 400 relay leg, so I had speed.
Yeah.
But what I needed was the endurance. And that was the main change I did after I'd run a couple of marathons. I realized that I needed to be have repeatable speed rather than flat out speed. So the rest of it was much the same. A lot of long runs, club nights would be hearing 8 miles or so around Canterbury, which effectively we would now call tempo running. Nothing different to when I see the training that Turgat, Gabor Selassie, probably Mo Farah doing now. There's not much difference, really. I think the difference is they're running their tempo runs a heck of a lot quicker because they're able to.
And do you look at, so when you come to running for brother, so kind of, I've heard a lot about you doing a lot of racing. And do you sit and think, like, when you're coming up with the training that you in preparation for, do you think of it as a long marathon cycle that you need X number of weeks to get yourself in an X position? Or do you, is it the fact that you're just generally you're doing a high volume of running and you can specifically train over a short period to get ready for a big race?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that I was marathon training 12 months a year and forfeited a lot of other stuff to do that. I'm fairly sure I could have run, say, a low 28 10K. But I never did because I would be running, say, the 3A's 10,000 championships off 110, 120 mile a week.
Right. Okay.
Always loath to ease down because the target was the marathon. And I knew I didn't have enough speed. I needed to be a 27:30 10K runner to succeed at 10K. So I decided, quite literally decided that I had to train specifically for a marathon. That was going to be my best bet to get to world level.
Yeah.
So I directed everything to being a marathon runner. And so 12 months of the year, I'd be on high mileage and the conditioning. Yeah, so the winter was always a good base. And then from that through February, March, I would start to run a little bit quicker. And then in the summer, keeping some mileage going, but because of the warmer nights, I'd probably do my speed work a bit quicker. But really, it was 100. Well, in 82, 83, I averaged 115 per week, a whole year.
Wow.
So that includes recovery weeks after marathons. So, so you can imagine that some weeks are much higher.
Yeah. So what did you pick up? What do you think is, looking back, is your biggest ever week? Have you ever recorded that?
It was 100 and just over 140.
Okay.
But I was school teaching as well, so I would be doing, PE lessons, and say on a Wednesday afternoon was sixth form games, so we would have mixed hockey all afternoon, and I'd join in, do stuff. So I never counted that as training mileage. So I would guess that I was probably 150, 160 miles a week if you counted all bits in. But proper running, what I would call training, 140 was the maximum.
Yeah.
And 120 more typical.
Yeah. Wow. And is there, like, see, with that, you're keeping about an incredible level of fitness through the entire year. In the build up to marathons, particularly maybe let's looking at sort of 82 and around that period, were there key sessions that you knew you had to do in the lead up to a marathon that would either tell you were fit enough to race or would put you in the position to be ready to run and on the day?
Not really. I never had one session where I thought, that's it, I'm back, I'm ready.
Yeah.
That came more in races than it did in training.
Yeah.
But I would know, I mean, if I was doing, six by a mile in February, I might be doing those in just under 5 minutes. But 2 or 3 weeks out, if I did the same session, I would probably be doing them in 4:35, 4:40s with the same effort. So you kind of gauge.
Yeah.
But the big thing was, I mean, I know in 83 before London, I did a 10-mile race in February and ran 48:30. And then 3 weeks before London, I did another 10-mile race and ran 47:11. So that's how I knew I was back on form. So it was, and just generally, your long runs are getting faster. My last long run with the Invicta lot, given that in London the year I won, Nick Braun from Invicta ran 2:13 and Martin Knapp did 2:17. I was training with two good guys, and I left them for dead in my last 22-mile run. So I knew I was in good form because everything was coming easily, and I wasn't feeling exhausted after any training session.
Yeah, and I guess running during the era, just mentioned two guys there in the club who could run sub 2:17 or 2:18. Like,
yeah,
how important was it that I guess you raced a lot, and was it easy to get out and just get these hard races? I guess we don't have quite the same level these days in terms of depth. Do you think now as a coach that racing is really important to get your athletes racing quite regularly to get them in peak condition for the big goal race?
Yeah, I do. And all the athletes I have, none of them shy away from racing in the end. Some of them race sparingly initially because they want to do a PB every time they go out. So, but I get them doing, cross-country leagues, race series, where they're running on a Wednesday night, maybe. Paul Evans, who I know very well, always used to say, he did the same thing, and he would call it training with a number on. So, in effect, you go out and run a cross-country league race. And if you won it, that's fine. But if you finish third or fourth, it really doesn't matter. It's part of your training.
Yeah.
And you could probably say now people go out and do tempo runs or run threshold using their Garmin or whatever more accurately. But I think there's something about the cut and thrust of racing cross country, particularly, which has a good effect in terms of your ability to race when it comes to the big day, but also kind of digging deep, without going for a PB every time you go out.
Yeah. And do you think there's like less egos? It's because there was such good general strength in depth. Like, do you think people didn't mind a few defeats and stuff because they knew that everyone was running so well and you'd go out one day and you'd win and go out another day, it wouldn't be a day you'd lose. I think, I guess now we've got, I don't mean this as a criticism because I'm running now and I'm part of that generation, but do you think, We don't want to lose, and therefore, I mean, I'm a perfect case in point. I don't like going out and getting beaten very much, and I'm nowhere near the standard of these guys. Yeah. Too, do you think the ego was less with runners back then?
Well, I'm not sure actually. I'm sure we had big enough egos, but I do think that people saw a lot of races as part of their training, so. Yeah. They didn't really bother too much if they won or lost. If they were losing races 5 or 6 weeks out from their key marathon, then they'd start worrying about it, I'm sure. But generally, I mean, the Kent League in those days had obviously myself, Keith Penny, he was a 47-minute 10-mile runner, 28-minute 10K, Nick Braun, 2:11, and for England cross country. There were some great people around. Barry Royden, who I coached, actually. A very, very strong cross-country runner, finished second in the national cross-country. So you get beaten by those guys. You don't worry too much because, it's the cut and thrust of it. I know for a fact that the 48-30 10-mile race I did in February, the year I won London, it was our club championships in Sittingbourne, and even Martin came down and wanted to have a bit of a spin. So I won the race, and then Eamon Martin finished about fifth. He just said, well, I mean, I'm not going to come and do any more Invicta club championships anymore. He wasn't bothered about it because obviously he went on in the summer and he ran whatever he did, 27-14 or 8, whatever his British record was at the time.
Yeah.
So we felt it was part of the process and there were not races which were important in their own right. So, but you were always beaten if you were beaten. You were beaten by some good guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's the same, you could do the Birmingham League and you'd be Tony Milosorov and Andy Holden and all those people. So not winning there. I mean, you're still in what would now be considered an international level race, but it was just a league race in those days.
Wow, incredible.
But I think that coming back, actually, I mean, I think people are running more cross-country and things now and getting back to racing more often. And that's part of the reason I think that we're seeing a slightly more depth now in British running.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's take a look at specifically at your two personal highlights, but looking at 82 and that Commonwealth Games performance and 83 at London, like it's all well and good sort of being in this position that you said you're running a high level of mileage throughout the year, but it's one thing to be able to run these times, but it's another thing to be able to compete at the front of the race. Like with the going to the Commonwealth Games, did you think you had a chance of maybe an outside chance of sniffing a medal? Did you think that was a possibility leading into those games?
I did. The big jump for me was finishing third in London in the April before.
Yeah.
And I ran 2:12:30, which kind of brought me into the next level. I mean, I knew in the Commonwealth Games, Rob Di Castello was, for all intents and purposes, the world record holder. Salazar had run quicker in New York, but it was a short course.
Yeah.
So Di Castello was considered the world record or world best time at the time. And then there were Shahenga, who'd won the previous Commonwealth Games, and then won the 10,000 at the Commonwealth Games I was at.
Yeah.
And a few others. But when I looked at it, I mean, take out two or three Africans and Di Castello was in with the chance of first five or six. And if it all went well, I had a strategy of not chasing the leaders. As it turned out, Shahenga and Ikanga, both from Tanzania, went out for then was a kind of 2:4, 2:5 pace, which was suicidal in those days.
Yeah.
You're taking a slight risk by hanging back. But I dropped back to about 10th or 12th in the race at halfway. I could still see the lead group, but they started to break up and you started to catch people. And I'd caught Shahenga, was the first to break from that lead group, caught him, got into fifth, and then moved up to fourth. And then I could see John Graham from Scotland, who'd run 2:9 in Rotterdam, just coming off the pace with about 2.5 miles to go. Caught and passed him to go into third place. And from that point on, you know, the strategy had worked. I was never going to catch Di Castello, and he was having a battle with Ikanga at the front, two and a half minutes ahead. But the strategy of finishing as high up as I could brought me a bronze medal. So I had to kind of think, well, I'm not going to beat Di Castello unless something dramatic happens in the race. So let's stick to my strategy and make it work. And it worked. So
great.
So I knew I had a chance of a medal, maybe not of winning it.
Yeah, fantastic. And then that obviously then that gave you incredible confidence to then go ahead to London.
Yes, it did, yes. And I was running PBs all over the place and a few surprising ones. I did the Imperial College's road relay in Hyde Park for University of Kent, quite illegally because I was a teacher then. I wasn't at the university and I ran under somebody else's name.
Yeah.
But I ran the fastest time of the day in a kind of 13:25, 13:30 sort of time, which was far better than any 5K I'd run before it. And I went from fourth to sixth in the race, 40th to sixth in the race. Just ploughed right through, brought the University of Kent up into the top 10, and then just went home. I didn't think anything of it. And then I got a phone call in the evening saying, are you the guy who, well, I can't remember whose name I ran under. Are you the guy who ran under that name? If so, you did the fastest time, but we're going to have to disqualify you. So, so it was a bit embarrassing. That result doesn't appear anywhere, so that, apart from my diary. But running that quickly in March, just off the back of fairly high mileage, gave me a lot of confidence that I'd made some superb progress through that winter.
What was the key to that progress? Think it was just feeling so on top of the world, or was there something specific about, I don't know, the way you...
Well, I think you have a golden time. I think I kind of progress gradually through the ranks from 2:21 to 2:19 to 2:18 to 2:17 to 2:16 to 2:12.
Yeah.
So the trajectory was upwards all the time, and I had a period of probably 2 years of running those 120-mile weeks without any interruption.
Okay.
You know, the occasional little niggle in calf or cold or something, but nothing that threw me kind of off balance. And I was able to progress all the time. So it's just, I don't know, the combination of a long period of getting in some great training.
And
it bore fruit in the end. So I think it was just that golden moment for a couple of years running 212 in London, 212 in the Commonwealth, and then 29 in London again.
And what was that experience like in London? Because obviously I read something about you had able to put a fairly similar tactic to the Commonwealths. You didn't go off with the
absolutely, No, I looked at the field and there was nobody that scared me, but I knew there was Kabiba Belcher from Ethiopia. In fact, a couple of Ethiopians and Emil Puttimans from Belgium, who'd been the world record holder at 5,000, had run 2:10, but there was nothing, there was no De Castella in the race.
Right.
And you always have a bit of luck in life, because in the Rotterdam Marathon, which was held the day before, De Castella, Salazar and Lopez from Portugal, all ran the Rotterdam Marathon, all ran around about 2:09. And then Ikanga, who was supposed to be doing London, missed his flight and didn't arrive in London. So kind of all the stars lined up for me. But I knew if I went through the first half at 64.5 and then you got 2:10, then that was probably going to be enough to win it.
Yeah.
As it turned out, Kabiba Belcher and Puttimans tore off and were running very uneven pace up until about 18 miles. And then they both suffered because of their... They were sort of sprinting for a mile and slowing down. We all caught up again. It was just crazy. But by 18 miles, everything had settled down. And Gary Helm from St. Helens and myself came to the front of the race, moved away, and then... At 22 miles, I managed to move away from Gerry Helms. So it was, as marathons were in those days, it's a slight battle of attrition, really. There's no negatives. You just ground each other down until someone was still standing and winning at the end. And that's partly because we never had pacemakers. You had to race. Personally, I think that's the way the sport should be. I understand why Berlin, London, and a few others want to have pacemakers and the USP of the race is really to get the world record. But races like New York, which don't have pacemakers, I think have a more interesting race.
Yeah.
Although they don't get fast time. So it for me, as a kind of purist of racing, I'd like to see people race rather than have pacemakers, who definitely alter the race and alter it in the favour of fast track runners.
Okay. And I was really, would that help us as because obviously at the moment we are effectively sort of Europeans and I guess Americans, we are running around sort of 2:10, 2:09 times, but we're a mile off the guys from East Africa who are running 2:03, 2:04.
Yeah.
Do you think that we can bridge that gap? And is that having non-pacemake race, is that one factor that could make a change?
Well, I think at a championship level, it will. We saw with John Brown, he got fourth in the Olympics twice.
Yeah.
But at that time, I hadn't run a 2:10 marathon. By running a smart race, he came through, and he was very unlucky in Athens not to have got the bronze medal, I think.
Yeah.
And then I think if you look at Callum Hawkins as well, his ability to race in the championships is far superior to the times he's getting in big city marathons.
Yeah.
Of any Brit likely to get in competition with the Africans over a sub 2:04 or something, Hawkins is the one, because he's currently running. He failed to break 60 for a half last week by 2 seconds, so he's significantly quicker than anybody else around.
Yeah.
Obviously Mo was running those times, but I think Mo's career probably is on the downside now because of his age.
Yeah.
So I don't see Mo bridging the gap to 2:03, but Hawkins is. At that point in his career, if he keeps improving, then the Commonwealth Games collapse aside, he's the one who seems to be a very smart racer, able to come through in races and would have a chance of certainly medalling.
Fantastic. But he hasn't had that experience yet of leading, crossing that line at London. What did it feel like to actually cross the tape? Do you remember much of those last few miles?
I was running on fear because I was getting quite tired. there was a bit of the commentary, which I've seen quite recently, actually, where David Coleman says I was on British record pace, and I was 2.5 miles out. But in the last mile, I significantly was slowing, sort of, not significantly, but I was, instead of running sub fives, I was starting to find that hard. and picked it up again in the last half mile. But Jerry Helm had kept enough contact that if I'd slipped enough, if I'd perhaps done a 5:30 mile, gave him a chance to catch. So I was still running a little bit on fear that because I was getting tired, it was a bit of a risk that if it fell apart by at the end, that I could get caught again. But the last from turning up Buckingham Palace to go down Birdcage Walk, which is the opposite to what we do now, I had a good glance back down the Mall to see where he was, and I thought, well, I just have to keep going now, and I've got this. So the last half mile was actually great. And it's something that you get great pleasure from the whole of your life. It stays with you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And people remember it as a performance still.
Great. And I was going to say, very few men have crossed the line and won a marathon from the UK, but also very few men have sat in front of the Queen wearing a string vest eating potato croquettes. Tell us a bit about
that's
story.
That's a story to discover around. Yeah. that was at the Commonwealth Games, obviously, in Brisbane. Yeah. And the Queen, it was the night before the marathon. I've not been ever a great one for carbo loading on pasta because it floats me out and I feel kind of stuffed.
Yeah.
So I normally have either whole grain rice or potatoes. Mm. And the only thing I could find in the refectory was potato croquettes. So because it was Brisbane, it was hot. It was 80-odd degrees every day. And the Queen came round at lunchtime of the Games visit and came round the canteen where I was literally sitting in a string vest and eating potato croquettes and stopped to ask what it was that I was doing to eat this such a strange meal. So I tried to explain that I'm trying to build my energy up for the race the next day.
Then
I asked her, actually, because the race started in front of the Royal Yacht Britannia in the harbour. The stadium in the Commonwealth Games was right on top of the hill. But it was starting at 7 in the morning, so I asked if she would get up to see the stars. And she said, no, she didn't think she would be. So, it's a nice story, actually. I forgot about that.
Thinking of you, Dana, did you... You mentioned you carb loaded leading up to it. Did you spend much time thinking about that sort of thing? Was I know Steve Jones famously says he ran 2:07, 2:08 with on a diet of Mars bars, but I'm sure they wasn't quite that true. But did you think a lot about how you were fueling your body back in that era?
I did, but I always had a good diet and I've always cooked for myself from when I left home as a student. I always cooked proper meals. Just because I wanted to be healthy, not because of any particular thing. But then I was invited to a British squad weekend at Keele University, and David Costill, who was a physiologist who worked on the carbo loading diet, was there and gave a talk. So I did a bit of research into the carbo loading diet. So I started to work on that for the last bleed out for 4 days and then 3 days of eating carbs, and did that for all of my marathons.
Right.
Sometimes it didn't work, I think, because it does take you quite low before bringing you back again. Mm. So it is a risky thing, particularly for traveling. So but the rest of the time, my mum was an army cook, and I went to school in the days when you sat down and had a proper meal with vegetables and stuff. So I think I always had good food, good healthy food, lots of vegetables, and I continued that right through. I still cook for myself, and I always aim to have a varied diet. So it's important, I think.
Eating well.
You can't rely on training to make you healthy, because if you're not eating properly, then it can affect your training and your racing. That's for sure.
And did you periodized your eating to a certain extent because you were doing that for the races, but you wouldn't do that sort of, you wouldn't make sure carbohydrate was more important on days of big workouts. You wouldn't think that deeply about it. It was more just a thing of eating healthy all the time.
No, I think just eating properly all the time. And I've come round, now there's much more talk about it, I've come round to believe that what I was doing intuitively is correct. I think I hear so much about having protein 20 minutes after you've been for a run and all this stuff, and I think there is a lot of science in that, but actually I think the body's pretty good over, say, a 24 or 48 hour period of correcting itself, providing you're fueling it properly.
Yeah, okay.
And there's so many people, I used to eat late in the evening because of my training. Other people, Sarah Rowell, I used to train with, did all of her training first thing in the morning.
Yeah.
And had all her meals at lunchtime, but never eat any fats. She'd have, before a marathon, she'd have skinless chicken and rice. I mean, everyone has different fads, and everyone has a different kind of diet. But as I say, I think it's providing you're getting enough nutrients in. When you eat and how you eat doesn't really matter too much, because the body's pretty good actually at correcting itself.
Yeah. And speaking of science, we can't really go much further, because obviously the marathoning today is being affected by usually by science, I guess, in terms of these new shoes coming around and various other things. And I guess a couple of questions, one of which is have we been through periods like this before? Is this, like, you often go through periods where barefoot running becomes vogue and then it goes, then it comes back again. Is there been periods before where there's been outcry about how the science is changing the sport? And I guess that's the first question that I should ask you. Has this happened before, or is it unique to this period that we're experiencing now?
I think there have been big improvements and big jumps. Certainly from, if you look at, Jim Peters, I've just picked up a book, or someone sent me a book of Jim Peters running the first sub 220, and on the cover he's clearly wearing a pair of white Plimsolls. And then not too long after that, proper trainers started to come, the Tiger Cubs, which are now Asics, which had a kind of gristly rubber sole, but a nylon upper, and that was probably during the 60s. And then, say, David Castile, along with Ron Hill and a few others, were looking at diet in the 70s. And that's really when there seemed to be the biggest jump in performance, where going from Jim Peters running the first sub 220 to people like Ron Hill running 2.9s in the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah.
That seemed to be the biggest jump. And not really very much happened until the late 80s. We were, Di Castella had the world record at a low 2.8. Most of us were running 2.9, so not substantially better than the likes of Ron Hill were doing. The biggest change came in the 90s. But I think that's another question. That's more to do with drugs and things rather than... I don't like to make any comments about those things, because I have actually no proof. I just have my own opinions on it. So but it does seem to be the next big jump came in the 90s, when they went from the 2.9 performances to the low 2.6s and the 2.5s.
Yeah.
But now obviously technology and footwear is now the topic of the month, and I guess the difference is that it appears that the shoes are giving an advantage, in the sense that they're returning energy more than neutral. So I don't know the science behind it, whether that's true or not, and I've never worn the shoes, so I can't really tell.
But, yeah.
It does, but then, it will equal out very soon. All the other shoe companies will have the stuff out.
Absolutely.
It's available to everybody at the moment. So whether it's giving, in development stage, it's obviously giving an advantage to those who have the equipment, but once they hit the market, everyone's got the equal chance. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's not cheating in the same way as taking drugs is. So it's a difficult one to answer. People seldom ask me whether I'd wear them now. And I would.
I was going to ask you that.
Yeah. I would want to wear the best shoes that Nike could give me. So without question, I would have worn them. If everybody else was. So it's a different question. I mean, I remember in the Commonwealth Games, the running kit that they gave us to run in was completely unsuitable for running long distances in. They just were almost like heavy cotton shorts. So we had to doctor, Ron Hill brought out the first string vests and Freedom shorts. The equipment's always improved, and there's always been improvement in footwear. I guess the question now is whether that the improvements now are giving an advantage better than say running barefooted, which which would be neutral.
Yeah.
I don't know how you measure that and find that out.
I guess we're going to see over the next few years how this is going to play out. But anyway.
Boom, I don't think it matters. I mean, to be honest, I mean, each generation has its iconic people. So you have Jim Peters, Emil Zatopek, those people from the 50s, and you'll have Ron Hill, Frank Shorter, Bill Rogers in the 70s, and I'd probably count myself, but certainly Charlie Spedding, Steve Jones, Bob DiCostello, those people in the 80s. Every generation has its stars, and everybody still recognises that. That doesn't change because there's always progress. There's always going to be faster times. So this current generation will have its stars, and they'll be superseded by the next generation. So it's just the way it is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we'll always find a new person, a new thing to moan about or fixate on, or whatever else. Yeah, but hey. But before we go, so I want to kind of summarise. Got a few questions, quick fire questions. I'll ask you at the end. But I just want to, obviously, we are doing marathon focus, and I guess now we're in February, and listening to your kind of advice from your training, I guess the key principle is consistency is key to achieving well at marathon. Is there anything you think for budding marathoners now, you'd say, like, I guess this spring marathon is probably maybe even too soon. What would you say is the key to, or the key from your perspective to being a consistent marathon runner?
I think it is regular training and not worrying too much about individual sessions and the ups and downs that come with that. So the consistency, as you said, is the key to it. And when I look at most top class athletes, it's the second or the third year as a marathon runner where they run their best times. It was for me, and even Paula Radcliffe, she started with a world record 2:17. But it was two or three years down the road when she ran the 2:15. And that's fairly consistent, I think, that once you've moved up to the marathon, you need a couple of years of getting all of that mileage in the legs before you reach your peak.
Right.
So it's consistency, whether it's high mileage or just consistent tempo running running at faster pace. It's being able to hold that together. And half the secret of successful marathon racing is being able to survive the training. There were certainly some very good athletes who were around in my generation who didn't run a good marathon because they couldn't quite handle that level of training.
Yeah,
but I couldn't touch them over 10K because they just, their training was far more intense than I was able to do. So,
good advice. Nice one, Mike.
Yeah.
And we'll ask those three quick five questions. So the first question is, if you could be anywhere running now, where would it be?
Probably Portugal or Spain at the moment. Just come back from Valencia and it was 23 degrees down there. If I'm honest, all of my training was done in the UK. I never went abroad. That came after my marathon when I gave up teaching. So you can train perfectly well in the temperate climate that we have. But it is nice to get away and run. In Southern Europe, I think in March, April time is ideal climate temperatures in the low 20s, balmy evenings, and not too far. You haven't got too much in the way of jet lag, etc., to worry about time changes.
Perfect.
So I would say Southern Portugal and Spain are the ideal places.
Great stuff. And your camp is March, April for the Algarve.
Yeah, middle of March. Yeah, we aim to have it 5 or 6 weeks before London, or as most people are doing the London Marathon. So that gives them the chance to do a peak week and bridge the gap between kind of winter mileage and then start moving towards faster training in the last 6 weeks for their marathon build ups.
Perfect. And our second question is recommend us something.
Recommend something?
Or a book or a film. Or anything basically other than something physical or an experience our listeners should try. You talked about
that's a difficult one. In terms of doing something different. One of my great passions is to find places to do really good races, and I went out to Bhutan 12 years ago and started working on putting on a marathon in the Himalayas in Bhutan, which is now in its eighth or ninth year. So that's in May. So if you're going to do anything extraordinary, then that's my recommendation, I think, to widen your horizons and don't just think about the marathon majors, although they are the bread and butter of my income. There are some great things out there. I went to the Swiss Alpine Marathon for 25 years. Fabulous races, and they're just great experiences.
Yeah. Get off the beaten track.
Sorry?
Get off the beaten track is a good bit of advice.
Get off the beaten track. Yeah, I thought you said get off the track. No. You need to do track running as well, but just certainly, yes, go somewhere new and different.
Great stuff. And in your opinion, third question is, what is the greatest endurance performance of all time?
Ooh, well, I did mention Emil Zatopek, and I recently read an excellent book on him, The Day We Die a Little, which is brilliantly written. It gives a great history. And Zatopek won the 5,000, 10,000, the marathon in the same Olympics.
Yeah.
And that's never been done before or since. But more than that, when you read the book and realise the difficulties he had training in Czechoslovakia at the time of German occupation and having to run around a forest in small laps because he was fighting for being shot and all that kind of stuff, you realise how the post-war years, performances and athletics weren't just about training. It was a lot more going on, really.
Yeah,
absolutely. So I think... That performance of 5,000, 10,000 marathon in the same games, it will never happen again. Although Vera nearly did it, it's very unlikely to happen again. And it was on the back, a background of a difficult part of European history, to be able to come out and do those performances at that time.
Fantastic. He's actually, we interviewed the guy who wrote the book, Richard Asquith. I think back it was. It was a few months ago, but it was a really interesting book. It was a great recommend. It's a good read.
Yeah, absolutely. Probably the best running book I've read, actually.
Great.
In terms of getting down to what it was really like, which is excellent.
Fantastic. Go and get it. Lovely. Well, thanks, Mike, for chatting. It's been great to chat and get your insight about marathon running. But and good luck for this year with your guys you're coaching. Have you got anyone going in the London Marathon this year?
I've got Lauren Cooper, who has been running extremely well, running personal best everywhere. She recently did 1:19 for a half, so we're hoping for some improvements. I think she's capable of a sub-2:40, but perhaps not this time out.
Great.
And a good friend who I coached for a few years before Bruce Tuller took over her coaching, Jenny Spink, has improved dramatically in the last 3 years. Sort of 2:36, 2:34, now down to 2:31, and she's running London, so hopefully she'll run. I'd like to see her get under 2:30, but it'd be a dream for her. So, yes, it's going to be interesting to see.
Fantastic. Well, thanks, Mike. Thanks for your time, and hopefully we'll catch up soon.
Lovely. Thanks a lot.
COTA just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your COTA fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with COTA. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.